Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Dr. Debbie Silver. Debbie is a brilliantly funny, beautiful, insightful, and boldly authentic speaker, author, and educator based in Melissa, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas. She has dedicated her life to understanding learning and growth behavior and has become a world-renowned and empowering speaker. Debbie is one of the most sought-after presenters for professional development in education. Through her research, her outreach, and her humor, Debbie seeks to help teachers find the joy in the daily job of teaching so that children can embrace the satisfaction and pride of knowledge, growth, and self-worth. Debbie co-wrote the 2014 bestseller, Deliberate Optimism, Reclaiming the Joy in Education, which offers research-based strategies, practical examples, and thought-provoking scenarios to help recharge educators in schools. With a healthy dose of humor to make it fun, Deliberate Optimism demonstrates the difference a change in attitude can make. In her most recent best-selling book, Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8, Teaching Kids to Thrive, Essential Skills for Success. She's rewritten and we're going to be talking about on the podcast today about some of the changes that have been made in that book. This book focuses a lot on the SEL-friendly classrooms and what that should look like, and provides a wealth of tools and strategies for those who want to teach life skills beyond the standards. Welcome to the podcast, Debbie.
Hi, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. I, reached out to you because you were a speaker at the AMLE conference last fall, and you had several sessions that I found very inspiring, a lot of resources, and you were going to be talking about some of the PD that you've been doing during the pandemic as well. But let's start off talking about the time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Probably, it's when people say, how did you get into teaching? Because that was not my game plan. And I had a whole other career path in mind, and fell in love, got married too young, 20 years old, and left college. I only had 2 years of education. I mean, 2 years of college education, but none of those were in the field of education because I never saw myself as wanting to be a teacher. But we moved to this little bitty town in called Logansport, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's right on the Texas border, population 1,200.
Wow.
And it was a step back in time. I mean, this was a time when the schools were still segregated. The mm-hmm. town was segregated. It was a little bit like Mayberry, RFD, except a lot of tension there. And mm-hmm. so I went in and started working at the family hardware store, and the superintendent came in and said, I want to offer you a job as a teacher. And I just started laughing.
Wow.
I only have 60 hours, and those are not in education. He said, we're desperate. And they were, because it was so poor economically. They had no money to pay. I think beginning teacher salary was like $8,800 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And also the federal judges had weighed in and said, you're going to start integrating schools. And you're going to start that process by inviting some Caucasian teachers, into your all-Black schools and mm-hmm. vice versa. So he said, we would like to offer you that opportunity to go to Logansport Rosenwald. Well, Rosenwald was like a block from my house. I could have walked there. And I said, I don't mind doing that, but I'm not a teacher. And he said, oh, just come on, help us out. I said, no, seriously. I said, I don't like school. I don't like teachers. And I don't think I like little kids. He said, well, they're not that little. And I said, well, what grade are we talking about? I believe it's a fourth grade position.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea how old are fourth graders. And he said, well, they're 8, 9, 10, 16. I'm like, no. And he was like, oh, Miss Pace, help us out. And that was my name then. I was Debbie Pace. Mm-hmm. And I'm embarrassed, Dana, because what I really thought was, that's got to be that's got to be, you know, beating into working in this hardware store. It can't be that hard. You know, I was a really good babysitter. And, you know, what do you do? You know, you go at 8, you get off at 3. And I signed all the paperwork right there in the hardware store.
So, wow. They had it all ready for you in the hardware store to go.
The hardware store remained part of my life. So this was June, and school was going to start in August. And I said, now look, his name was Mr. McLaurin. I said, I really don't know anything about teaching, you know, at all. What happens next? He said, well, school takes in, that's redneck, for begins. School takes in on August the 24th. And I think out there at Logansport Rosenwald, they take in around 8 o'clock. So on August the 24th, you'll want to get out there at least a quarter till 8.
Uh-huh.
Period. No training, no books,
no
guides, no nothing. And now I'm an idiot, so I'm going, well, okay. And the thing was, back then, they didn't have any money. They didn't pay teachers to come and work, you know, in their rooms. There was nothing going on in the summer. The school just locked up tight. Couldn't even get into the school. And teachers did not come back till the day school opened. And that was the day kids came also.
Yeah.
Everybody shut up. So I show up, and, you know, people are, they're a little leery because I'm Caucasian, and it's an all African-American school, but people were friendly to me because, you know, I was friendly, and they just thought I was an idiot because and come to find out my room is out on the playground. I had that little army barracks room they brought in for the overflow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go out there, and it's, oh my God. You know, it's dirty wooden floor, you know, paint peeling off the walls. And I'm just standing there with my purse and I'm thinking, I probably should have brought a poster, but I don't know what fourth graders like.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, a teacher that later became my mentor had said, you know, I'm going to bring your kids to you because they don't know they're getting a Caucasian teacher and it might scare them. So I'll get them prepared and I'll bring them in. And she did. And I looked at them and I said, you guys are really short. And I said, what grade are you in? And a little girl said, first.
And oh, wow.
No. I'm the fourth grade teacher. And of course they started crying, you know? And then I said, wait, no, please don't do that. And because we didn't have an awning, it was pouring down rain. And I knew I couldn't take them all to the office with me. And I didn't know what to do because the intercom was broken, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a note to the office and I said, dear office, there are first graders in my room. What should I do with them? And we waited for the note to come back and it said, dear Miss Pace, you're the first grade teacher. Teach them love the office. Oh my God. So I've got all these kids. And we didn't have pre-registration. Our parents had no transportation, no way to get to the schools. So they just got on the bus with their birth certificate and their shot record. Mm-hmm. And I'm the one that's supposed to do all the records. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure all this stuff out. And of course, I'm from Texas, and this is Louisiana, and the certificates don't even look the same. And I can't make it all work. And a lot of them, you know, it was like father unknown. And I was not knowing what to do. And, you know, I'm upset. The kids are upset. I'm trying to play, you know, who's your daddy? And it's not going well. And I just started crying. And the minute I started crying, my first grader stopped crying. And
oh, wow.
I just sat down on that little dirty floor. And the kids all piled up around me and they're brushing my hair, you know, and they're patting my face. Don't cry. It'll be okay. Breathe. And I said,
wow.
I have to tell you something. I'm not from Logansport and I'm not doing very well. That's okay. Don't cry. I said, no, see, I'm not even a real teacher. And they were like, no kidding. I said, but at lunch, I'm going to quit. Well, then they start crying again, you know, don't leave us. And I went, no, I'm not going to leave you by yourself. See, I'm going to go over to the office and I'm going to resign. And then they're going to get you a real teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we don't want a real teacher. We want you. And then I just burst out and I said, why? And honestly, they told me one of the most important things I've ever learned about teaching. And they said, we want you to stay with us because you're nice. and because you care about us. And they said, we don't want you to leave because you love us.
I said, wow.
That is so true. I said, but y'all are the nicest people I've met in Logansport. I said, but seriously, I need to leave. And they said, no, you have to stay. Mm-hmm. I said, guys, I don't know how to teach. And my little first graders looked up at me and said, we'll show you. And when they said that, I just said, all right, you know, let's do this. And it was crazy. I mean, I didn't know anything. And I'm out there in this little army barracks room by myself. There was another first grade teacher, but she was in the building and she was kind of had her hand in everything else. She was too busy. You know, we didn't have mentors or any of that. So I'm just trying to make my way and try mm-hmm. to learn to teach. And I know at one point about Christmas time, I had some kids that still were not reading even basic sight words. And realized these kids had never gone to kindergarten. I was their first teacher in their entire lives. And so I felt like such a failure. Mm-hmm. And the teacher, Miss Murray, who was my mentor, said, Miss Pace, she said, you need to give yourself some time. And this is something we never talk about anymore, but we should. She said, there's this thing called readiness. And mm-hmm. when those kids get ready, they will learn. And she mm-hmm. said, you're going to be shocked. She said, give yourself till after Christmas and see what happens to you. And so I did. And sure enough, after Christmas, some of those kids, it's just like the light went on. They had mm-hmm. to reach that, you know, that perfect moment, you know, to start learning. So we made it. We made it through the first grade. And the thing was that I had 4 or 5 out of my 24 students that didn't learn to read well enough to go to second grade. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the principal and said, I'm going to have to hold them back. And he said, you can't. And what we knew then, what we believed then was if you passed a kid when they weren't ready, you mm-hmm. were sentencing them to failure the rest of their lives. And so I was devastated. And I said, why not? He said, and part of it was because I was Caucasian. And if I mm-hmm. didn't pass them, it was going to be this political. So he said, pick 3. And I was like, I can't do this. I'm not gonna do this. And he said, Miss Pace, it's the only way. Mm-hmm. So we did that. Well, it turns out we had a shift in our student population and they didn't need a first grade teacher
okay.
except for that 1 year. So they said, we're gonna move you up to 4th grade. And I was like, no, you know, I need my first graders. And I went, no, you're going to do 4th grade. So I did 4th grade, loved them because they got my humor a little better. And somewhere in there, I looked back, I got 2nd grade, I got 3rd grade. Mm-hmm. But when my life changed was when we finally integrated our schools. And when they did, they made me a middle school teacher. And I'm fighting and screaming, going, no, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not who I am. That's not what I know how to do. And I walked into that 6th grade class the first day, and they got my jokes. They got my mm-hmm. humor. They laughed at the appropriate times. You know, they didn't wet their pants. I really have a lot of ADHD, just like squirrel. And that worked a lot better because first graders mm-hmm. are just so sweet and they're so, you know, but they would tell me stories like, you know what? And then one time, and you know what else? And then, but first, wait, okay, first. And I'm like, what is your point? So when I found where I fit, mm-hmm. it was like the light came on. I always loved it, but I really loved it when I found my place. The mm-hmm. other thing was that people say, well, how did you make it, you know, being Caucasian in an all African American school? And also I'm a city girl, I'm from Fort mm-hmm. Worth and I'm in this rural school. And I think the best thing was I was so young, you know, I was 20 and so naive. And so I wasn't judgy. It was like when I would hear about things that were said differently or done differently, I'd go, really? You know, why do y'all do that? And then mm-hmm. they explained it to me. I'd say, oh, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always said it's hard to not like somebody who loves your kids. And I think that was the big thing was I so loved those kids and they were just amazing. And I think people understood that because, you know, after a while I had a choice. I could have transferred to another school, but I didn't want to. I mean, I loved where I was. And then I found my fit. You know, I started teaching science, which was funny because I hated science when I was in school, but I think it made me a better science teacher because I didn't assume anybody knew anything. And I'm very hands-on, need to touch it, hold it, feel it. And so that's the way I taught it, even before that got really popular. So it just, when I think the irony is, and I tell teachers this all the time, when those little first graders said, "We'll show you how to teach," they did. Because I didn't know anything. I didn't know about, you know, differentiated learning. And so I had kids that really struggled, you know, with reading and writing, and some of them with math too. But I'd look at them and I just look at their spark in their eyes and I go, "But you know this." And they're like, "Yeah." And I go, you can tell me this, but you can't put it on paper. And that's when I just started figuring out, okay, I got to figure some way for these kids to hold it, feel it, touch it, see it, to make sense to them. So without anybody having to tell me, you know, I just broke away from, because what I was doing was what our teachers did, you know, when I was in school. And that didn't mean it, you know, as trying to be horrible, you know, it's just the way they learned. So they expected everybody else to learn that way. And then here came this teacher just that's not like everybody else. But when the kids would go, "That's really hard," I'm going, "I know, you know, I had trouble with that too. You know, let's find another way. Let's make it into a song or let's make it into a dance or a cheer." And so differentiated instruction started for me early on, just watching the kids and seeing what worked. So that was my struggle. Didn't intend to be a teacher, didn't want to be a teacher. And after just, you know, a short amount of time, I realized this is the most important thing I can do to contribute to the world today. This is it. And later on, when I wrote my book, Fall Down 7 Times, Get Up 8, and I was talking about, you know, grow where you're planted. I think that was it. You know, I was caught in a world, and I love Logansport. Don't get me wrong. I learned so many important lessons from being in a small town that I never got from living in a city. But when I said, okay, and it looked like we were going to live there all our lives because my husband's family and their family, you know, we've got. So it's like, okay, I'm here. You know, this is what's available. All the things that I had planned to do, be a writer, be a comedian, that's not really on the table right now. So let me grow where I'm planted. And I was very curious and very eager, you know, to try new things, which was also very, very helpful. And I guess a lot of it was just the appreciation. I was so glad to have that job and so glad to have a chance to be, you know, a little bit creative because when you're selling, you know, nuts and bolts, there's not much creative going on there.
Yeah. Wow. That's such a amazing story, basically, because you fell into education from being in that hardware store, right? And then meeting a teacher. And then the fact that you kind of were talked back into not resigning that same day by the first graders, right?
First graders, yeah. They're like, "Please don't leave us."
And you learned so much from them, right? You built those relationships with them, found out how to teach them. They taught you how to teach. And then, you know, you discovered different grade levels and kind of found your niche. So, yeah, that was definitely an evolving process. But, like, you know, a lot of people today, you wouldn't, you know, just be kind of picked off the street or from a store job to become a teacher. But, you know, you were able to do it, right? You were able to learn as you went, right? And that worked. And, you know, you stayed in education. And like you said, grow where you're planted, right? And we're happy to, you know, you have contributed so much to the field of education. So
well, it was interesting because as soon as I made that decision, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life, I immediately would drive across the border back into Texas and went to Stephen F. Austin State University and finished that first degree. And to hear these professors who hadn't been in a classroom, you know, in 20 years pontificating. And I've just walked out of a classroom, you know, to get up to my night courses, and I'm sitting there going, that is a bunch of crap. That is so not right. And we had a teacher one time at the university that said, a good lesson plan will solve all your discipline problems. So, but I loved, you know, I had some really great teachers at Stephen F. Austin that loved the fact that I was doing what I did. Mm-hmm. And this was also a time, it was the early 70s. So, you know, we're going through a really, the individualized instruction, mm-hmm. the put the kids first, you know, it was John Holt. And my teachers had me reading those people. So that was my first influence, you know, were people that really believed every kid deserves a reasonable chance at success. Mm-hmm. And I believed it. And so I had a lot of support. And then later when I went to LSU Shreveport for my master's, that's when I really learned theory because I basically missed all that, you know, as an mm-hmm. undergraduate. So that makes me question, how much of that do our undergrads really need? Mm-hmm. And when I taught at the university level, you know, what the students gravitated to were my stories about teaching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these circumstances, and what did you do here and why did you do that? And I'm a huge believer in finding your own voice as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, don't try to be me because it's not going to work for you. You know, I'm obviously an extrovert and I was using my humor, you know, in the class. And I was also writing some. I wrote letters to all my students, even when I taught over 200 kids a day in middle school. I would write everybody letters and tell them my favorite things about them, my dreams for them, you know, what I hope they'd remember about being in the classroom. But I'd say, that's who I am. I really liked doing that. But you have to be who you are. And if you're an introvert, you know, or if you're that concrete sequential, you're going to be a benefit to kids that I'm not reaching like you will. Mm-hmm. So that's huge for me. And I think the reason I'm still in this, these many, many years later, is because I was able to, all those things I wanted to be, like a comedian and a writer, well, I kind of am. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was able to reach that, you know, by being myself and doing it my way as a teacher. But, mm-hmm. you know, continuing to learn from others because, Lord, I had to learn everything. I didn't know how to take up lunch money. I didn't know anything. But you can do it. And, of course, you're not going to let people like me in the classroom anymore because, you know, I've got to pass the praxis and all. But I do have I really think their second year in college, if people know they're going to be teachers, we need to have them in schools. You know, mm-hmm. I need to teach my classes in a school. And a lot of universities do this. You know, I should be home-based in a school so that they're constantly seeing what it's like, what it means, you know, what are the kids like when the classes, you know, come into contact with an irate parent, but get a real feel for what it's like and not this idealized, you know, I'm going to have my perfect little bulletin boards and I'm going to have my perfect little goals and we're going to meet those. They need to be realistic about it. And I think mm-hmm. if we had an internship, maybe like Canada does, where we pay people to be an intern their first couple of years, I think we'd have a better rate of people staying in the profession.
Exposing them to classrooms earlier on in their program. Yeah, because a lot of the time, you know, they're doing that their last year or even just their last semester of their bachelor's. So,
and when I taught at Louisiana Tech, people would always say, "Why do you have so many middle school science teachers coming out of Louisiana Tech?" But I would teach everybody, you know, the mm-hmm. pre to high school teachers on the introductory. And I'd hear these kids say things like, yeah, I guess I'm going to teach first grade. Give me those little rugrats. And I'm going, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about middle school with your sarcasm? Really think you're missing it. And then I'd have some of my, you know, precious little introverts going, well, I really think I might want to try middle school. I'm going, could we just let's rethink that, all right? Let me give you some things to ponder because it's, I guess I've been in it so long, it's kind of easy for me to see where people are going to fit. And I think so many times we lose teachers, not because of the profession, because they're in a place where they don't fit. And it could be the wrong discipline. It could be the wrong age group. It could be the wrong school, or it could be the wrong wing of the school. And you get tossed in with the negative Nellies and you lose your optimism. You know, you lose your focus. And so that's why it's so important to me that we get mentors out there who really love and believe in kids and communicate that. And I was blessed because I got that from my university professors. And I, honestly, they were a bunch of hippies. Let's just be honest. That's who my teachers were. Just a bunch of hippie freaks. And I learned so much from them. And that goodness and that kindness and that compassion aspect was just, that's all they wanted to talk about. And they had us read a lot of really good books, not about theory, but like just about kids and about kids who overcame adversity and kids that made it happen. And a lot of books about how one teacher, you know, changed lives for kids. And that was so inspiring to me. And I kept thinking, I want to do that. I want to be that teacher. I want to make this happen.
You were already doing that, though.
Well, but I was limping along. You know, I tell my students now, and I still hear from ones that I had way back in the early 70s who are now grandparents. I'm like, oh, my God. But they'll just say, you know, Miss Pace, you were the best teacher. And I'm like, no, I really was not a good teacher compared to what I know now. But it goes back to that connection that you make. I made so many pedagogical mistakes. I mean, I did, seriously. I shouldn't have been there. But I think as far as the connections that I made, kind of hope made up for some of my errors about, you know, technically how do you teach? But that came pretty quickly, you know, because teachers are sharp. We have to be. And we pick stuff up. And once I figured out, okay, it's more than just the heart of teaching. There is an art to teaching. And I've got to learn that too. And of course, today, young people have the advantage of the internet and so many resources because I used to buy books with my own money. You know, I'd go out and I'd buy books about teaching and maybe there'd only be two or three strategies in the whole book that I could even use that were even applicable to me. And you know, workshops, we paid our own way to go to workshops and paid for a sub to go to workshops. But I did because I learned so much. And sometimes when I'm talking to people new in the field, you know, and I don't want to sound like, well, we walked uphill both ways to school in the snow. I don't want to sound like that. But I do want to say, please avail yourself of these resources that you have at your fingertips. I mean, you can find, if you can't think of a creative way to do it, there is somebody out there that has already thought of it. And they'll share it with you because that's the way teachers are. You know, it's, oh, please take it, use it, make it better. You know, give it to other people. And for us to ignore that, and when I taught at the university level, you know, I really try to impress upon my students what those resources were and how valuable they were. And, you know, you don't want to get overwhelmed with it, but find a few that you really support and believe in.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Follow them. And then try some of those suggestions. And they won't all work for you, but that's okay. You know that then.
Yeah, so kind of talking about resources, I said in the intro a little bit about the revisions on your book. They're coming out in May. And tell me a little bit about what you're adding and how that'll help teachers who are planning their lessons and looking at curriculum as they plan for the 21-22 school year.
Yeah, that was my favorite book I've written. I've written four books, and two of those are co-written with other authors and other teachers. But my favorite book I've written was Fall Down Seven Times, Get Up Eight. which was my second book that I wrote. And it was about what we're talking about now, about building resiliency, building resilience in students, perseverance. And I see that, you know, when I run into the students I have had before, they tell me things like, you're the one that taught me, you know, to keep going and keep trying. Mm-hmm. And so I was out of the classroom. I'd been teaching at the university, but I would go in and do guest presentations in classes. And I'm a science teacher, so, you know, of course they're going to be excited. I've got rockets, you know, I've got snakes. And I'd usually set up in a central location, and I'd tell the kids, all right, you know, when you finish, you know, whatever it is that you were working on, come on over here, and I'm going to show you some cool stuff. And I would have kids that would just sit there, and I'd say, are you coming? And they'd say, well, what do we get if we come up there? I'm like, what do you get if you come up here? Let me tell you what you're going to get if you don't get your little butt out of it. And so I start looking around, you know, and I'm visiting a lot of schools, and I'm seeing this entitlement thing. And I'm like, whoa, you know, and somebody better come help me. Somebody better come do this for me. And I thought, no. We need to address this, mainly because I think it's my generation, the boomers, that caused all this in the first place. And I talk about that in the book. But, you know, so many times when I'm working with teachers, they're like, Deb, we totally agree with you in theory. Yeah. We know that you're right. But what does that look like? I mean, how would that work in my situation? So the book is actually for parents and for administrators and for teachers. But I'll take a theory like self-efficacy and how do you further that with the way that you give feedback. And I give very specific ways to do that. And then I'll give examples. And, you know, because I'm me, some of them are kind of funny and off the wall. But you get the idea. And it'll say, instead of saying this, say this is better. Or this is even better. But then I'll explain the theory and why. So it sold like 18,000 copies, and it was doing really well. And my new editor, because my old editor retired, and Ariel Curry called and said, Deb, would you want to do an update? And I was really thinking about writing a new book. I thought, you know, that would be terrific, because that book was written before the pandemic, before our social revolution, so to speak, before virtual learning. And I said, you know, I need to revisit this in terms of what's going on right now in schools. And there's some things I need to add. So when I redid it, I had found so many videos, and I'm that person, you know, I'm the picture smart person. Show me a picture and I'll remember. So we did QR codes. So you can actually be reading the book, put your phone on it, and watch this quick video that has that actual author speaking or has an actual, you know, explanation. So that was something real positive. Then I had so many questions from the first time about how does this work with gifted learners? And two of my sons were identified as gifted and talented. So I have a lot of, you know, investment in that. So I pulled one of the chapters talking about growth mindset, Carol Dweck's work, and aligned that with giftedness for parents who have that kid that's been identified as, you know, just exceptional in certain areas, because they too get that entitlement sometimes. I live with a couple of them and I know it's true. And then I honestly had to face the digital world. So I have a whole chapter, and I went in and read, you know, several books that people have been reading, you know, about what the captivation with the digital world is doing to our kids in terms of lack of perseverance, lack of initiative, and I start the book talking about that. I said, if the pandemic showed us nothing else, it showed us that our kids are not really good yet about being self-motivated learners. We had such a huge number of kids that once they came out of a classroom where they were closely shepherded, closely monitored, closely scripted, and now they're away and they can't raise their hand and ask a question every time they want to, a lot of them just defaulted and said, well, I can't do this. You know, this is too hard. And so my point is, we've got to give those kids the way that you you approach a problem like that, it's, you know, okay, here's what it is. Here's what I can't control, but here's what I can control, and what can I do about it? So I make the argument that I think all kids are motivated learners until we beat it out of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, kids, they're naturally curious, and they want to investigate, and they want to know what's going on. And, you know, watch them do the things they want to do, you know, like mastering a new skateboard trick or mastering a new level in their video game. Okay, well, I don't see that as a bad thing. I see that as something we should learn from. We, the educators, should say, what is it that is engaging that child that we can also capture to help engage them in things that maybe not seem so fun right now, but to teach them that a lot of times, and, you know, we have to establish that credibility with our learners to say, I understand what you're saying, and I know this is not the fun part. As a matter of fact, I hated this when I had to do it. But let me just assure you that where you tell me you're wanting to go, nobody ever got there without doing the steps we're doing now.
Yeah.
So this is just part of the process. We're going to do this, and I'll help you think of ways to make it more fun, you know, or to make it more entertaining, but we're not going to skip it, and we're not going to smooth over it. And that's my problem right now. It's the parents that my generation raised. I have five sons, so and lots of grandkids, so I watch it, you know, everything the kid does. Good job, buddy. Good job. You breathed in. Good job. You exhaled. Wow. I'm like, guys, too much. And I've got a chapter about feedback, and actually it should be a letter to Debbie, because I was always so over the top with my effectiveness. Because that's who, oh, you're a rock star. Oh, man, you're going to win the, you know, the Pulitzer Prize. You're just so great. And I got a little indication one time. I remember when I was teaching middle school, two little girls, one, they were talking about something. One said, well, go ask Miss Pace if she thinks it's any good. And her friend said, she, you know, I could hear her. And she said, no, that won't do any good. She likes everything. And I thought, oh, you know, at first I thought that was a compliment. And then I thought, but I have no power with that child. I have no credibility. In other words, I can't believe Miss Pace because she likes everything. So that was not the role I needed. So I understood I had to stop just this over the top stuff I was doing, but I didn't know how to change that. The other thing was, because my students, you know, some of them didn't even have indoor plumbing. They had nothing. And I had this existential guilt because I'd gone to this huge high school that taught five foreign languages. You know, we had everything. So I'm in this little school and my heart is breaking for my kids. And I had a lot of sympathy. And what Brene Brown, you know, from Texas, who's studied shame and guilt, and I love her, has taught me is that sympathy will separate you from others. It's like, oh, you poor little thing, you don't have as much, so maybe you lower your expectation. Whereas empathy, it teaches us to hear them and listen to their stories and say, I understand how hard this must be for you. And I understand that maybe you don't even have a table where you can make your salt map, which is what happened one time with me.
Yeah.
But to say, okay, but here's my goal for you. So let's you and I work together on something you can do. So we can see what you, how you can shine. And so my empathy, my sympathy has changed to empathy over the years, thank goodness. But I'm still learning about proper feedback, which is still very hard for me. You know, Dweck says you don't tell people how smart they are. You don't tell them how talented they are. That our praise should stay on what they can control. If you're constantly telling kids you're so pretty, you're so smart, you're so gifted, you're so blessed, you're so talented, that either leads them to feeling entitled, and at some point they are going to top off, and then they're going to be mad because they're going to think they were sold a bill of goods, or they're going to hear you saying that to other people and think, I don't really have that, and so they learn to be helpless. I'm not even going to try. Because I wasn't born that talented, or I wasn't born to a place where my dad's the coach and can work with me. And we're giving them excuses, you know, not to succeed. So my idea is we take kids wherever they are, you know, race, gender, socioeconomic, religious, don't care. Take them where they are, not where we wish they'd be, not where they ought to be, not where the teacher last year said they were. Where are they right now? And then we raise the bar just beyond their reach for every single kid, that you're always reaching to the next level and that that's a good thing. The fact that you had to work hard, the fact that you had to stumble, the fact that you did a complete U-turn in there, those are good things. Those are positive things. And we say that and model that and reiterate that to kids so they get it in their head. When I make a mistake, it's just a fall. You know, it's not a fail.
Yeah.
Failure is just a temporary circumstance that teaches me something. So what I've learned to do with students, and this is all in my book because I talk about it, is when somebody does, you know, a total face plant, and we all hate that, it's so embarrassing. What we say as the adult advocate is, man, that had to be hard. Nobody likes that. So what you learn from that, and always reiterate, there's a lesson in that. And, you know, be real with them going, that probably just embarrassed the fire out of you. And I know that you don't want to go to school tomorrow. I get that. I'm right there with you. But let's talk about the things you can control. And let's talk about the things you can't control. And let's maximize those things there. What can you do about this? Well, everybody else is, you can't control what other people think. What other people think is none of your business. Let's control what you think. And, you know, I'm big into role playing, and I have that throughout the book, is to prepare those kids ahead of time so that they're not faced with major decisions in the middle of crisis, that that's the first time they've ever thought about it. So it's a great thing for parents, you know, especially, but also teachers to say, you know, we're going to go on this field trip and let's just kind of brainstorm some things that might happen and what would we do? What would be the best for everybody? But they already have that toolkit built up so that in times of crisis, in times where that amygdala in their brain is going full force, that prefrontal cortex has a few tools to go, wait, you know, I have choices here. And make them understand the consequences of their choices. So, you know, I may get some pushback with this book. My husband says that some of the things I'm saying are going against what a few groups are now saying about how people should be entitled to certain things because what's gone on in the past. And I'm going to say what I've always said. You know, I'm not as much interested in the past as I am right now. And my job is to help every parent, no matter where you came from or where you are right now, to help you maximize your child's fullest potential. I do believe that all kids can learn. I think they learn at different times, but they learn. And I do believe they learn best in a place where they feel safe, where they feel supported, where they feel heard, and where they're not judged all the time. So, you know, don't even start me on standardized tests. Another thing I can't stand, and I make several smart remarks in my book about that. But I just feel like, you know, it bothers me that everybody's talking now about our learning loss through the pandemic. I'm going, loss according to what? Because the whole world has been through the same thing. We've all, you know, not been in our routine. But where did it come from Mount Sinai saying that by fourth grade, you have to master these, you know, math skills? All right, you didn't get it because of whatever reason. So let's get it now. Let's do it now. I mean, we're operating from a deficit theory. And here are all these people far removed from education making decisions about what goes on in education, which really ticks me off. But it is that deficit, look what happened to us, you know, Eeyore, instead of looking at those teachers who the day that we closed the schools, went home, got online, rolled their sleeves up and went, well, I better learn this virtual learning because I don't know squat about it. and they did it, and they did what they needed to do. And mistakes were made. Well, hello, you know, it's that's part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I'm dealing with teachers that were veterans like me, saying, "I just need to get out of the profession." You know, I didn't want to teach like this. This isn't why I got into it. No. And I'm like, could you just think about when you first started teaching? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you have everything in place? Did you have your routines and your procedures? And, you know, you could shoot from the hip, because no, you had to learn all that. But you gave yourself time to learn it because you were new. And people would say that, well, she's new. Mm-hmm, they did with me, she's new. She's from the city, you know. But that's... we needed to give ourselves some time, and administrators needed to support that. But I also do this thing with learning styles, and I've talked about what people with different learning styles need to get for themselves for virtual learning. Mm-hmm. And that we curriculum planners need to make sure that happens for them, because we know concrete sequentials really just need a step-by-step. They also need a timeline, because that's how they function best. You know, first do this, then do this, you know, teach me the program, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the me's out there, the abstract dreamdom, just going, well, let's just do, ooh, squirrel. You know, just something cool, fun, you know, oh, I found this last night, guys. Let's take a look at this. And, you know, somewhere in between, we have to make it okay for teachers to teach in their own style. Mm-hmm. But what we started getting was this scripted curriculum, because everybody wanted to control everything, you know. Yeah. Let's do it. I'm like, guys, you're going to lose your teachers. We got into this because we're autonomous, because we want to be ourselves and be with our kids. And let's not forget that resource is your greatest resource you have anyway. Mm-hmm. And I've always said, if the teacher ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's invest in our educators who are killing themselves. But, you know, make it as easy as possible as we can for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think administrators and, you know, instructional coaches and people that support teachers have learned a lot throughout the past year on, you know, giving teachers support, giving them time, and also encouraging them to take time for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what kind of professional development you've been hosting this past year, and maybe some schools that you've been working with, and then what do you have maybe planned for early summer, if you're going to be a keynote speaker or a breakout session at any well-known conferences?
In a few, yes. Most of, I was, you know, on board to do some really well-known conferences, but mm-hmm. those got put on hold. I just did a series for ENTAES. It's a European association that's really, it was a pleasure to be invited. I'm their keynote, mm-hmm. and also doing some in-depth research on two different books. But they, for the most part, and this has been fun because it went from classroom management and things I usually do, you know, the ball dance seven times, get a bait, and teaching kids to thrive, which is social emotional learning. Although that's seeing a big bounce now. People mm-hmm. are saying, yeah, we do need that. So I'm grateful about that from the pandemic. But immediately, because I'd done a couple of free webinars for teachers on called Practicing Safe Stress. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. And it was about, you know, how crazy this all is, but how to take care of yourself. Well, that actually came, it was a part of the book, Deliberate Optimism, mm-hmm. Reclaiming the Joy in Education. So that just kind of took off, and people were saying, can you please talk to my staff? You know, they're so beaten down. They're beating themselves up. You know, can you talk to them? And it was amazing because some of the things I've been talking about for several years, you know, about taking care of yourself, mm-hmm. Control what you can't control. Well, now that's everywhere. Everybody's yeah. talking about that, which is great, because if, as long as people get the message, you know, I don't care where they get it, but they need to understand it. And I think people have always, you know, when I've delivered, it's like, you know, that's really true. And, you know, particularly administrators, you know, maybe I ought to think about that. But now we feel that need, you know, mm-hmm, my mm-hmm. teachers are on that just looking for somebody to choke.
Because it got to the breaking point, right?
So they're reaching into their tool bag. So that's a lot of what I do is just tips. And basically what I tell them is, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know. I mean, taking care of yourself, there is nothing new out there. But I'm going to give it to you from the perspective of a teacher and a mother, you know, and how this would work. And I just want you to take it and apply it to your life. And, you know, I teach with stories, so I have lots of stories. And I love, you know, great quotes, so I'll offer that for teachers. But I try to not get real. I read the theory, understand the theory, but I figure right now most teachers just, you know, hold off on that. We want to hear about, you know, how do we build a positive school climate? You know, how do I take better care of myself? Those are my two main ones right now. I mean, almost everybody asks about those. Now I'm starting to get some things about drumming to the beat of different marchers. I just did that with Colleen, and these were high school. But what are some ways we acknowledge and address the needs of kids who do learn in a different way, which is one of my favorite topics. That's what my first book is about. But my kids at Rosenwald taught me that, you know, just because I'm not a strong reader, just because I'm not really good, you know, manipulating numbers does not mean I'm dumb. It just means I have to work harder. And so I'm very mindful of that. So I'm trying to think this summer, what I really love to do is open up school, you know, conclaves. And I like that. And, you know, get people ready to roll. But I've told principals before, I said, I'll come and I will be in August. So most will be in person, but a few will be still virtual. But I say, when you really need me, it's probably January.
Yeah.
You know, because most people are pretty excited about school starting. You know, it's like, oh, this is so cool. We're so excited. And I don't mind. I love that. I love being back around all of that. It reminds me of, you know, I want to get in my room. I want to get my stuff ready. But I think that I serve probably a greater need when I come after school has started and the dew has worn off, to remind teachers, okay, here's why you're doing what you do. You know, just in case you forgot, because it is easy. And if you're a new teacher, you don't have those stories to fall back on. You don't have that kid that came, you know, you had 15 years ago that said, you changed my life, you know, and you're like, what? You know, what's your name? But when you have that, you have that power within you to say, I'm going to keep going. And I, in my presentation on deliberate optimism, what I say is we owe it to our kids to be optimistic. Even if you don't feel optimistic, you need to convey that. And I'm not saying pharmaceutically induced, you know, it's the way you look at the world and the way you frame things, because I never want anybody out there teaching who says, you know, away from the kids, it doesn't matter what I do. Nothing I do is going to change things. You know, the administration's against me. The parents are this, the kids are that. And I'm like, if that's what you really believe, please resign. Please resign yesterday, because you don't need to be here. I only want people in front of kids who believe that what they're doing does make a difference. Maybe not as much as we want, and probably not as quickly as we want, but it does. It does make a difference.
Well, out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
Here's my go-to phrase. Every student deserves a reasonable chance at success. Now, let me just explain that for a second. We're talking a lot about equity. We're talking a lot about fairness. We're talking a lot about a lot of things. And people are disagreeing on the definitions, and I'm confused by some of it. But I think every educator knows what reasonable means.
Yeah.
Even what that kid has and who they are and what they've been through, what can I do to help them go to the next level, whatever that is? And it may be four levels below where you wish they were, but we have to start with where they are. So they need a reasonable chance. And I think everybody knows what I mean by that, a reasonable chance.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast and learning so much from you and hearing your thoughts about a variety of topics that are really, you know, they're really trending today. And you know that you've been working a while on the teacher self-care and, you know, social emotional learning and all those type of things before it really took off this year. Where can people find you online and connect with you?
Just go to debbiesilver.com, www.debbiesilver.com. And my website, you can connect with me in any way there. And if you want to email me, it's Debbie at debbiesilver.com. It's really simple. But I answer all my email. I answer teachers. I have teachers that write to me all the time. Just some of them just need to be heard. And, you know, if I don't do anything but go, I understand. You know, that's got to be hard. That's what I want to be. I want to be a resource for teachers in any way that I can do it.
Great. Well, I'll make sure I have that information in the show notes. Thanks so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
Dana, this, I can't believe an hour's gone. This is so fun.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.